papermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press. Now, you remember Mrs. Sadie Smuggery. She wanted money to buy a new...
The Media Project is a half hour of commentary and analysis of what's going on in the news media, an opportunity for us to give you some insights into decision-making in American newsrooms here from Studio D in the Alan S. Chartok Broadcast Center here on Central Avenue in Albany. I'm Rex Smith here with Judy Patrick and Barbara Lombardo and a special guest, Judy and Barbara, of course, being, as I am, former editors of newspapers in the community. We're here also with Mitra Kalita. Mitra, welcome to the Media Project.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, we're so glad to have you. Mitra has a really interesting background, which is why the happenstance of her coming through Albany and being able to stop by our studios is a great thing. Former managing editor of the Los Angeles Times, former senior vice president of CNN, now in some very interesting media work down in New York City that we want to talk about because it suggests something about how the media ecosystem is changing. So we'll talk about that. And you know, as we get into this, maybe Barbara and Judy, we might think about how we witnessed the media change. Think about from the start of your careers until you left your editorships. Give us a couple of the things that changed so dramatically that you think about of how different it was from the start to the end.
Oh, wow. So at the beginning, we used to have to run down to a courthouse and get documents. Then we had fax machines. Technology increased the ability of reporters to do their jobs quicker and more easily. Then I saw the technology work in the back shop where the papers got put together so much more quickly. I remember when we moved to our new building on the outside of town in Schenectady, we had 160 people in our newsroom. And when I left, you know, 20, 30 years later, there were fewer than 40. We didn't realize we were in the golden age of journalism back then when we had such wonderful resources. We had 4 editorial writers. We had 4 people in our library clipping old newspapers. So we saw great advances in technology, but then we saw this dramatic decline of the paper, the local newspaper, the local printed product.
You probably have a similar story.
Oh, like multiplied by 10 or 100 on steroids, the same issues. But I think that the biggest changes that I've seen are who controls the news, who distributes the news, and the trust in news. Hmm. Those are huge and not good news.
And not good news in that. And so, Mitra, you've been at the intersection of all of that as well. And we actually should make note of the fact, an interesting tidbit we just found out about Mitra's background. You were a New York State Young Journalist of the Year in like 19...
Well, actually, I think it was early 2000s.
I was still considered
young then, but yes. I think it was 2002. I should have looked it up. The Mike Hendricks Award is what it was called.
Associated
Press Bureau Chief in Albany. Yeah,
we well remember Mike. He was a great guy whom we all worked with. So how about that? And so you went from that to being an editor at a thriving, powerful, one of the 5 largest papers in the country, mm-hmm. the LA Times, then to CNN in some of its glory days. And now you're running nonprofit newsrooms based in New York City. What are you doing at this point?
Sure. So I was at CNN in the spring of 2020, and probably like a lot of people, had an existential moment of what will the rest of my life look like? And, you know, CNN, just to kind of paint the picture, you know, obviously most people have heard of it. I ran the digital arm, which most people don't know. CNN's homepage is the most powerful news homepage, arguably in the world, right? There might be some outlets in India and China that kind of do some circles around it in traffic. But you know, just as far as like, this is a driver of a news agenda like no other place I've ever worked. And so my team was running that homepage. And we were in the middle of a pandemic. And, you know, my neighborhood of Jackson Heights, Queens, that's where I live. I've lived there on and off for the last 25 years. And we were called the epicenter of the epicenter, right? The ambulance sirens were constant. The news trucks, including CNN, were parked outside Elmhurst Hospital. And so we were considered the face of the pandemic for quite a number of weeks. And I have to tell you, running CNN's homepage and living in this neighborhood was one of the most powerless feelings I had. And I'll tell you why. In that moment, people are looking for everything from COVID tests to a hospital bed to a ventilator. And then there's the flip side of it, right? You remember the search for yeast and what are the lines like at the supermarket? And so in my group chats and my neighborhood listservs and just kind of the little contact we had with neighbors, that was the chatter, right? And CNN's homepage as a national and global news product was almost anonymous in its ability to serve at that level. And so for me, I just felt this, you know, I come back to the word existential of like, what am I doing with my life? Am I of service to my community, right? What is the point of scale if when you Google, where can I get a COVID test in Jackson Heights, the best result might be, you know, some of these neighborhood listservs I'm on or Facebook groups or, you know, people who are really trying to do the important mutual aid work. But CNN is the top result, but that's not going to be localized, right? And so I kind of share this very almost nerdy example of how algorithms and scale are actually at odds with local news and our ability to get trusted, vetted, not just information, but life-saving resources. And so to kind of speed up how I entered this universe of local news, I mean, on my career, you know, I was at Newsday in the early part of my career, worked at the Associated Press in Trenton, New Jersey. I come from a local background, but I also feel like, you know, the community has been a theme of my entire career, even when I worked in big media. And so as one of those neighbors, as one of those community members, a lot of people were asking me and my husband and my family, you know, where can I get COVID tests? Or do you know sort of that, do you know? And then you insert what people are looking for. And so we launched what was just like an email list of about 50 people just to kind of field these queries, put them out into the universe, go to similarly minded people in Jackson Heights and our neighboring areas. And that listserv developed into Epicenter, which today now boasts about 35,000 email subscribers. It's grown way beyond an email newsletter. But, you know, I share that because it's a very organic story of how a news site was created out of crisis, but also out of not being served by the biggest of the big and just my awareness of not being useful in that moment as the CNN executive.
So you've created some niche sites, let's say, for particular audiences. But the peril is that a niche site can't exist unless it gets enough audience, right?
Oh my gosh, totally, totally.
How do you balance that going for the niche that will make a difference versus the need to actually finance it?
Yeah, well, the finance piece is important. So while Epicenter has a nonprofit arm, we actually were founded as a for-profit. And I think that's just an important distinction because the ability to fund this, to your point, is not just really important, but also kind of a big question mark for all of us, right? How do you fund news? And so when we launched, again, like this was a organic creation. People needed this. We did this as an email newsletter. How do you combat these forces of algorithms and scale? But it's not just algorithms. Like at CNN, you know, I had a team and their whole job was to figure out what is Google doing to us today, right? So if it's National Taco Day, I'm going to write 6 stories on tacos. And like, that's just not how local news works, right? And I think there is a, I mean, I wonder how you're feeling about this. It feels like everyone and their mother is talking about local news. And so I'm sitting before you all who've spent your career in it. And I wonder if you feel a certain way about us, right? Like CNN executive is suddenly like, oh, wait, did you guys know that the algorithms are against these small outlets that might be producing better information? And so I also want to acknowledge my own naivete in running at scale and kind of succumbing to what the internet was making us do in national news, which is catering to not what communities needed, but what the robots told us was trending.
But we all did that.
Okay, well, then I don't feel so bad.
No, you don't need to at all. Everybody was trying to figure out what the algorithms would do to you. And while you had certain stories that you knew you had to cover, you were constantly trying to second guess you needed to do to actually get some attention to it, or how you shaped the stories, what you did to them to kind of make them appealing to the social media that was your lifeblood.
Yeah.
And it turned out to, of course, be a fool's errand because the algorithms change abruptly, the priorities of the social media platforms change. And so you end up thinking, and maybe this is what has given rise to this whole ecosystem that you're a part of, which in effect the newsletter ecosystem, you know?
Well, I thought that would be a direct play, meaning people are asking for help. Email was the medium in the pandemic that felt safe. Text messaging, WhatsApp also as well. And we had groups eventually, just to give you an example, when the vaccines rolled out, you know, we were in this quandary because so much of Queens that we serve, you know, the neighborhood I live in has the most restaurant workers of all of New York City. Restaurant workers are supposed to be at the front of the line for vaccines, but it was this Byzantine system that depends on you having really good internet, really good digital prowess to kind of navigate, you know, registering in all these sites and some availability in your schedule to take whatever appointment you can get. That's not how restaurant work functions. Most people work multiple jobs. You know, Sunday night is a busy time. So we developed a volunteer group that was actually coordinating on WhatsApp. And so I share that just as an example of the nimbleness of, in many ways, a community news organization that was like, well, let's meet people where they are, right? A lot of these workers are on WhatsApp. People want to coordinate as volunteers to help them access digital information that they need. And so in many cases, we were able to pivot very quickly, which having run large newsrooms, I mean, you all know it's really hard to get people to change and sort of say, we've been doing it this way. Now we're going to be on this platform. Could we just try? It's okay to fail. Once you have more than, I don't know, a dozen people that you kind of need to turn around, I think that transformation becomes really difficult. And Rex, I just want to pick up on one more thing that you said, which was like, how do you combat scale? And so I realized very quickly, Epicenter is not going to surface in search results, right? Like, I mean, we do now because we've gotten on Apple News. We've done a number of little tricks that, you know, you have to do video. You're on multiple platforms. The number of times you publish is really important. Eventually we got there, right? But in the beginning, we might be the best resource to help you get a COVID vaccine, for example, in Queens, but that's not going to show up in results. So what did we do? Because I come out of gaming algorithms and, you know, there's a certain amount of swagger I think you have when you work for big media. And you're like, I don't want to not be taken seriously by the internet. Like, what's happening here? And so I launched another company. I had no desire to run two media companies, but this is what happened just as a pragmatic point. I said, what if we took all these small sites that are serving people right now, banded together, and could we achieve the scale of a CNN, but not achieve the anonymity, this belief that you're serving everybody and thus serving nobody? Could we retain the trust that we enjoy in our communities, but leverage each other to achieve some form of scale?
And so you are achieved by a multiplicity of voices coming together.
Sure. Mm-hmm. And we focused, this was 2020. So we were in the post George Floyd moment. And so we said, you know, there's suddenly an interest both financially in supporting Black and Brown media, but also there's a realization among mainstream media that maybe we haven't been serving all these voices, right? And I, as someone who's advocated for diversity her whole career, I had never seen anything like the racial almost reckoning that we saw between 2020 and 2021. And we could talk about the anti-DEI movement, but I just want us to stay in that moment where mainstream media was like, oh, how do we get these voices? And so I looked around and I said, well, Epicenter is new, but the Haitian Times has been around for decades, mm-hmm. right? WURD Radio in Philadelphia has been around for decades. India Currents in San Francisco has been around. I mean, there was all. And so I just started to kind of turn to people who I knew and I said, hey, did you guys know that when you publish good information, Google makes it really hard to find it? And they laughed and they said, welcome to local news. Welcome to community media. Welcome to being small. And I said, well, would you want to work on this experiment with us where we maybe try to achieve scale in our content? Maybe we approach advertisers together. And this is where the for-profit piece was just important because I felt like the sustainability of these news operations rested on advertising. We thought we might do some licensing deals with mainstream. We had all these ideas, you know, that were kind of part technological, part collaborative, but also really, again, I just want to kind of situate us. There felt this optimism and willingness to partner I mean, ironically, we're in an anti-DEI moment, which maybe we'll talk about, but I still feel there is this desire for small news outlets to collaborate with each other. And if that was stoked out of the pandemic, if there was something, I actually don't think we've completely lost that 5 years later. And so our network has grown. And so URL Media stands for Uplift, Respect, and Love. We have 35 media outlets. We publish their content on our homepage. We refer traffic to them. We got a number of the partners on Apple News. We're trying to operationalize this centralization that feels impossible when you're small. And so to Barbara's point about ownership and kind of the centralization and who controls media, I don't love the way ownership works of media chains. And I've certainly worked in, I mean, I always used to say, like, if you want someone to acquire your media company, just hire me, because I was at, like, Times Mirror to Tribune, yeah. Rupert Murdoch at the Wall Street Journal, AT&T buying CNN, Warner Media buying CNN. I mean, and you guys are nodding because you've been through this too, right? Like, this has also been the backdrop of our careers. Anyway, I'm rambling now, Rex. Fix me. What else do we talk about?
I think you actually have something important here, because you're saying that in your 35, did you say?
35 partners, yeah.
35 partners.
Yeah.
And so I think that there's some of that that's going on now in the local news ecosystem around the country, too, where you see, for example, the publisher of the newspaper that Judy edited now owns several community newspapers, right?
Right, 5 or 6.
Yeah.
One of my questions is, what does scale bring you?
I mean, it brings you discoverability, right? So I do.
And what does discoverability bring you?
Does that bring revenue? Is that what?
So there's two things. One is, you're not trusted necessarily through the internet, but people are turning to the internet to begin their interaction with news. Whether we think it's news, whether they think it's news is up for debate. But if somebody needs something, in many cases, they are turning to the internet for an answer. And I do think it is incumbent upon us to try to meet them there, right? And so I see that as one action. I should say we're also at food pantries giving out flyers and QR codes and kind of rethinking our formats of what the news should look like. But I do think so many people begin their engagement of something they need with an internet search. And I think sometimes the best information is not the one that's what's surfacing for them. If anything, right now, there's forces against us that are also algorithmic and kind of institutional, if you think about Russian propaganda and so forth. I mean, and so that's like the responsibility I think we have to try to game those same algorithms to the best of our ability and get in front of them. The second, to Rex's point, is the revenue piece. I have yet to do a pitch, and I thought I knew advertising. And then the last 5 years, my Lord, have I kind of learned so much more about this. I have yet to do a meeting with a potential advertiser that doesn't want to optimize for reach in some way. Now, they definitely want action, right? So if you only reach 12 people and those 12 people are buying cars, that matters. But the first question tends to be, how many people do you reach? And so I'm trying to maximize that. And that network of 35 helps me get to 27 million, which, you know, is comparable to any large national news outlet in a way that Epicenter, when I tell you we have 35,000 subscribers, you know, those are two very different numbers and thus two very different clients we can pitch, right? That's just our reality.
A curious reporter, I looked up your partners and I was so impressed by the diversity of the types. And there's nonprofit newsrooms, there's podcasts, there's newsletters, and they're from all over the country representing all different types of voices. So how would I, as a regular old person, find your voices?
Yeah, it's a good question. So the multi-platform piece is the best thing about us. It can be the hard thing when it comes to selling, because what do clients also want? They want one common denominator, right? I want, you know, a X100 by Y100 ad that I can put as a banner across all your sites. And to your point, if someone's a podcast, you know, the best way to reach them might be something that a host reads. So how could you interact with our content? So we publish every day on url-media.com. And that aggregates the best of our 35 partners. We also are nodding to each other. So Immigrantly, one of our podcasts, just, and when I say our, they're in our network, of course. Sadia Khan might take exception. She's the real owner of Immigrantly podcast and the force behind it. You know, Sadia's in Westchester. She just launched an arts and culture podcast. And so as she did this, she nodded to some of the content from Documented, which is one of our other partners. And so there is a referral within the network that is, you know, if you like my stuff, you might like somebody else. And I think this is an important shift from when all of us entered media, which was much, or journalism, which was much more of a competitive landscape, right? Your goal was to be first. Your goal might also be to be the only read, right? This idea of comprehension. You're sitting down with a newspaper from, you know, beginning to end. Most of our partners operate in a way that acknowledges you're going to read other things.
Yeah.
Right?
And search engines love referrals.
Totally. So I feel like we're more of the internet than kind of trying to get newspapers to, you know, I mean, do you guys know this? You've been through this when you're trying to get reporters to put hyperlinks in their stories and they're like, wait, what? We're so competitive with each other and now we have to like, and that's just not, it's not how we were trained.
Yes, although it did become finally for a while an ethical issue. Remember the ethics codes of journalism began to say link whenever you can.
Totally.
That is really the appropriate way to acknowledge where information came
from. And try to link to the person who was first or, you know, I mean, as someone who's now doing a lot of aggregation, I'm so grateful that there is a comprehensive version of, you know, this type of story out there. And I think you're right. There is a culture of that more than there used to be.
Of course, your executive producer won't like it because it's taking you off their site, but still, it's it's a good thing to do.
In your search for continued financial backers, mm-hmm. how does politics come into play, or how are you anticipating politics coming into play where people might be reluctant to support if they are concerned about the nature of the coverage that they're supporting?
Such a good question. So we thought 2024 would be a good year, right? We thought it's an election year. This vote is critical to both parties, actually. And guess what happened? We did not have the political money that we expected. Why? Some of it was the Biden to Harris switcheroo, but a lot of it was that the campaigns ended up really focusing on swing states. Now, we have some partners in swing states, but, you know, I think you guys agree because we're in a part of New York that supports this. I think every state is a swing state, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, we keep focusing on a handful of states at the peril of the rest of the country. And so from an advertising perspective, that was harmful, right? It's harmful to local news when we're only going to have national spend on a handful of places. And by the way, it's going to nationalize what we're spending on. So it's the evening news. It's more traditional spend than on local trusted networks, right? And then the other place that the Harris campaign spent a lot were influencers, right? Both spent and also kind of put a lot of energy at the DNC. And so I just kind of share this granularly because I think 2026, we're looking now to the midterm elections and saying, did anybody learn from the mistakes of spending and where you're putting your energy, and that right. local communities are actually where, you know, if it's going to be a 2-3% swing, meaning everyone is on the table, we really need to focus on communities that feel left out of either a national news agenda or even a mainstream news agenda. And so we are making the case. And I don't even think it's a partisan case. I think, you know,
It's
a practical case. These are communities that yes. warrant your attention, right?
I think that there ought to be a training issue, perhaps, for media buyers. The short, easy way to do it, to buy the big sites, to go where the most eyeballs are. Young people who are entering the media world need to recognize that it is harder to buy local, to reach these intensely niche products, but that's where you'll have some real power. You can really have an impact. So I think it's actually what you've done is, it seems to me, a brilliant concept to basically a decentralized multi-platform network, but it is aggregated for content and distribution. You really are getting a lot of voices together in one place. I think that's actually a good business model.
We think so.
Imagine that.
We think so. The challenge right now, and this sort of is where the pendulum has swung, it feels, and I don't think this is just black and brown media, it feels like cutting the media off financially at the knees is the point right now.
Yes.
And that means, as hard as all of us gathered around this table are working, there are forces against us that our ethics here might not be enough. And so I think most of us in the industry are doing our damnedest to make it work. But it does feel like what we need more than ever is solidarity in the media, meaning kind of more of a network, nodding to each other, sharing best practices, being less opaque about just the economics of our industry, right? And the second piece is the financial support for journalism. And that, I think, has to come from everybody. It's from advertisers. It's from Fortune 100 companies. It's from small businesses. It's from philanthropy. It's from government, some of the advertising recs that you and I have talked about here in New York State, and, you know, very big budgets across agencies. And are you spending with local news and members and subscribers? And so when people say, like, what is the answer? I'm like, all of it.
All of the above.
We need all of it. And we also need an understanding of the public that the financial support of journalism is the underpinning of democracy. And so we, you know, we keep saying journalism as the fourth estate, like we're needed. I think we've, and democracy dies in darkness, but the financial support is so critical to even enabling that in the first place, right? And somehow, I don't know that we've quite made that connection as articulately as we should be.
Well, you just have, actually. And I think that might be a great place for us to end, because this show will air after a fund drive. And so we are here in a studio that is supported by listeners, where people who actually do pay attention to what they value and put their money behind it. So it's actually a great point for us to raise that we appreciate the people who make a difference and enable us to keep coming to you. So, Mitra Kalita, CEO of URL-media.com. If you haven't seen it, Uplift, Respect, Love. A great name. Barbara Lombardo and Judy Patrick have been here with me. I'm Rex Smith. We are grateful to our producer, Dave Vestina. And thanks to all of you for joining us this week once again. We'll be back next week on The Media Project.
Interesting people. Their policy is an acrobat.
The Media Project is a national production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. This week's projectors include former Times Union editor and current Upstate American Substack columnist Rex Smith, Judy Patrick, former vice president for editorial development for the New York Press Association and former editor of the Daily Gazette, Barbara Lombardo, adjunct professor at the University at Albany and former editor of the Saratogian, and Mitra Kalita, CEO of URL-media.com. You can listen to The Media Project anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. I'm your producer, David Gustina. Thanks for listening.